In the 13th program in the series, Kenneth Moore examines the popular music scene in Britain and America as the world moved towards the Second World War, a time when the British danced and sang the Lambeth Walk, while in America, Ella Fitzgerald's A Tisket a Tasket became a bestseller, and Judy Garland popularized Over the Rainbow.
Looking back on the last days before the full stop of the Second World War, it seems to us, gifted with hindsight, that it was impossible for people not to see what was coming. But that's not the way it looked at the time. Life drifted on with no apparent change. An international crisis or two, Mr. Eden's black Homburg disappears from the Foreign Office, and one day trenches are being dug in the parks. But people hoped and assumed, and perhaps even prayed, that nothing would really happen. The crazy gang occasionally stopped its joking for a moment so that Flanagan and Allen could revert to their early role as singers of hit songs. And in 1938, the pair of them touched a chord in the national consciousness with as sweet a drop of nostalgia as you could ever wish for. By 1938, the record was a bestseller. But songwriter Jimmy Kennedy recalls a bit of difficulty with the writing of it before Flanagan and Allen did their stuff.
I had the idea of Hometown in my mind for a long time. And when I mentioned it to Michael, he thought, this is great. This is the very kind of thing they want. And it had to be a simple song. And we had some trouble with this song because we couldn't get it right. And we had the beginning, we had about six bars, and then it sort of fell down. And then suddenly, when we were on our way to play it over to Mr. Black at the Palladium, we suddenly had this idea. And that gave it the lift where it needed it and made the song a hit, I think, about the Corny Country Cousins. In America, they changed it. They changed it to Cozy Country Cousins, which nearly wasn't so good. But they're a little hypersensitive about corn over there.
I can see a bunch of small town hicks squatting round the local floor whittling sticks in my hometown. What did I ever own down? I must be crazy.
Though the city girls are not so slow, take me to the corn-fed girls I used to know.
I'm pining night and day for that old time you won't pay.
Hometown. Wander, wander round your back streets. See a tumble down of shack streets. I'm going back to see those corny country cousins of mine. Hometown, where they get up in the morning, and they're all so busy yawning. I'll get a welcome from those corny country cousins of mine.
I see an old schoolhouse door we used to tumble through at four.
There's a small candy store where I could go with dozen lollipops and shout for more. Hometown, where the garden trees are shady, that's where Edie was a lady. I'm going back to see those corny country cousins of mine.
Hometown, Bud Flanagan and Chesney Allen. A gentle and perhaps typically British hit record of the period just before the last war. In the United States, the big bands were still making the pace, and Hollywood was still the great source of most of the musical energy in the popular field. But one odd thing did happen in 1939 on Broadway that wasn't typical. Jerome Kern wrote a song which actually he didn't think would be popular. This freak came about in a mild failure of a Broadway show called Very Warm for May. And in this show, Kern had placed a ballad which he said he liked very much, but which he said was too difficult for the public to get hold of. Well, even a Jerome Kern can be wrong sometimes. Now here's the song that was never going to catch on.
promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long. You are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a loveless heart. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and someday that moment divine when all the things you are.
Leslie Hutchinson, Hutch, singing All the Things You Are, the song that Jerome Kern sadly predicted would never catch on. Which just goes to show the wisdom of the most famous remark Kern ever made: go on being uncommercial, there's a lot of money in it. There was also, surprisingly enough, a lot of money in Shakespeare, and the first songwriters to have this happy thought were Rogers and Hart. In 1938, somebody had mentioned to them Shakespeare's A Comedy of Errors, and in no time at all, Rogers was making history, although he sounds pretty modest about it.
Well, I think The Boys from Syracuse was the first Shakespearean musical. It was many years before Kiss Me, Kate. And Boys from Syracuse, I think, presented no particular novelty, outside the fact that it was based on Shakespeare, and had only one line in it of Shakespeare's. But it did have a score that lasted, still played a great deal today, and had a revival just a few years ago that was very successful. Which is always a good sign.
This can't be love because I feel so well. No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs.
This can't be love, I get no dizzy spell. My head is not in the skies.
My heart does not stand still, just hear it beat.
This is too sweet to be love.
This can't be love because I feel so well, but still I love to look in your eyes.
This can't be love because I feel so well. No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs.
This can't be love, I get no dizzy spell. My head is not in the sky.
My heart does not stand still, just hear it beat.
This is too sweet to be.
Because I feel so well, but still I long to look in your eyes. Rudy Valley and Francis Langford with This Can't Be Love from The Boys from Syracuse, the Shakespearean musical that predated Kiss Me, Kate and West Side Story and all the rest of them. It had a successful Broadway run, although nothing like the mammoth four-figure runs that Rodgers and Hammerstein were later to enjoy. But in the 30s, on Broadway, production costs were much smaller and runs much shorter, and perhaps even the songs more melodious. But a lot of the hit songs weren't coming from the theatre at all. By 1939, three of the most popular musical ladies in the world were three sisters whose close harmony expertise made the Boswell sisters sound a bit quaint. Patty, Maxine, and Laverne Andrews.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some, until I first met you I was lonesome. And when you came inside, dear, my heart grew light, and this old world seemed new to me. You're really swell, I have to admit you deserve expressions that really fit you. And so I've racked my brain hoping to explain all the things that you do to me. By mere beast of shame, please let me explain. By mere beast of shame means you're grand. By mere beast of shame, again I'll explain. It means you're the fairest in the land. I could say Bella, Bella, even seven derbar. Each language only helps me tell you how grand you are. I've tried to explain by mere beast of shame. So kiss me and say you understand. By mere beast of shame, you've heard it all before, but let me try to explain. By mere beast of shame means that you're grand. By mere beast of shame, it's such an old refrain, and yet I should explain. It means I am begging for your hand. I could say Bella, Bella, even seven derbar. Each language only helps me tell you how grand you are.
The Andrews sisters, one of the definitive sounds of the end of the post-war era. Or should it be three of the definitive sounds? Anyway, nobody ever heard them perform separately for more than a few bars, so it's as a trio that they've been remembered ever since. The Andrews sisters eventually graduated into pictures, but it was as recording artists that they made their first reputation. This wasn't true of another singing lady, who had been a teenage rival of Deanna Durbin's at MGM and eventually stayed on there when Miss Durbin moved over to Universal Pictures. This young singer, a Miss Gum, made a few pictures in the late 1930s, appeared opposite Mickey Rooney in a series of teenage sagas that have since become movie history, and was now moving towards the great peak of her long career under her stage name Judy Garland. One of the many professionals whose path crossed Judy's was Gordon Jenkins.
To me, Judy Garland, Al Jolson, those kind of people were what they were on the stage. And if they had irritating or odd ways of life off the stage, I figured it wasn't any of my business. Nor the public's. I don't see how you can expect Al Jolson to be the same as the guy that sells you the gasoline. It just doesn't make any sense. He's giving something to the world. And Judy was the biggest star that I've ever seen. While I was around, she never did anything when she wasn't on the stage, except it was funny and a lot of laughs. And I did a lot of stuff with her. I did 5 weeks in London with her. And she never missed any shows. I wouldn't let her. I insisted that she go on. I had a million tricks. I'd go backstage and trick her into getting on the stage. Once she got on the stage, she was fine. Then other people conduct for her, and I'd read where she didn't show up. I wouldn't have allowed it. Literally. I didn't believe in it. We had an instance in London where she really did. Every night she lost her voice, but most of it was fake. One afternoon, she came in. She really was in bad shape. She couldn't talk. So she said, "I got to cancel." I said, "You can't cancel. You've got people coming to this matinee that came from miles around, the remote parts of England, on buses, and saved their money to come and see you. You can't send them back home. I won't let you do it." She said, "What'll I do?" I said, "Well, I'll play real softly and you talk. Tell them that you have a trouble and talk the show, and I'll play real quiet. And while I'm telling her this, I'm pushing her literally onto the stage. Then I have to run like hell down the stairs to start the music. So she won't go back to Jessica. Anyway, she does the whole show. I went back to the hotel, and the woman that ran the cigar counter came up to me and says, "Oh, Mr. Jenkins, I saw this Garland show. Best thing I've ever seen. Great, long ecstasies." I said, "Well, that's fine. When did you see it?" She said, "This afternoon." And Garland, Judy was so good, this woman didn't know she hadn't heard her sing. Never occurred to her. She hadn't sung four bars in the whole hour and a half. But it was such a performance that this particular woman, who was just like anybody else, never realized that she'd talked the show instead of sung it. That's what talent is.
Dear Mr. Gable, I am writing this to you, and I hope that you will read it so you'll know. My heart beats like a hammer, and I stutter and I stammer every time I see you at the picture show. I guess I'm just another fan of yours, and I thought I'd write and tell you so. You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. You made me love you. And all the time you knew it, I guess you always knew it. You made me happy sometimes. You made me glad. But there were times, sir, you made me feel so sad. I didn't want to tell you. I think you're grand. That's true. Yes, I do. Indeed, I do. You know I do. I must tell you what I'm feeling. The very mention of your name sends my heart reeling.
Judy Garland, reviving the old pre-First World War hit. At that time, despite the amazing maturity of her recording technique, she was still little more than a child. Although once involved in the Hollywood machine, it was not as a child that any of the businessmen regarded her. Alan Jones is specific enough about that.
When she was a child, right after she made this picture with me, they realized her potential and they pushed and pushed. And they started giving her Benzedrine in the daytime and sleeping pills at night to get the most out of her, and they worked her so hard. And this was the beginning of depending on a drug of some kind. And it went from bad to worse.
But before it went from bad to worse, Judy Garland was cast as a child. And for the last time, as it happens, which is pretty symbolic, in an MGM superproduction where the lyrics were written by Yip Harburg, and the music by Harold Arlen. Neither Harburg nor Arlen forgot the affair.
When you mention Harold Arlen, you examine his music. You see completely original form. It's not Gershwin. It's not Porter. It's his own. You can't mistake an Arlen tune. My mama done told me stormy weather. Any one of those things. Even when he went into the more romantic forms like Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It has a sweep of a symphonic music. You could almost take that and make a symphony out of that first theme of his.
I had finished all of the songs but the early song in the picture, which later became Over the Rainbow. Harburg and I had completed Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, and I knew I needed a broad theme, and I didn't have anything that pleased me, and I was terribly worried about it. Well, when I told Mrs. Arlen this day that let's drive over to the Grauman's Chinese Theater, which is in Hollywood. And as we passed Schwab's, something happened. I wasn't thinking, wasn't conscious of it. A tune presented itself, and I told Mrs. Arlen to drive over and stopped the car. And she did, and I took out my little manuscript paper, which I always carried with me, and I jotted down the first theme of Over the Rainbow, and that was it.
Somewhere over the
Over the Rainbow by Judy Garland, one of the great performances of the modern era by one of its greatest artists. Not surprisingly, that song won the Oscar for the Best of 1939. But there were great singers around of a very different kind from Judy, and if they never won a tenth of Judy's popularity, well, that didn't necessarily mean they didn't deserve to. Around this time, the band leader, Artie Shaw, had the revolutionary idea of hiring, for his all-white touring band, a colored singer. That decision in those days took a lot of courage, especially as the singer in question, Billie Holiday, was a musician singer, rather than a popular singer in the conventional sense. Artie Shaw seemed aware of all this at the time, but he still went ahead.
When I brought her into my band, it was obviously a rather strange place for her to be. Our music wasn't like any of the music she'd usually sung with. I mean, she early on sang with little black pianists, unknown. I say little, meaning unknown. And then later she worked with Basie. And I always used to say to Billy, when I was a young kid and I first met her, I said, someday I'm going to have a band, you're going to sing in it. And she'd say, yeah, that'll be the day, because it was unthinkable that a white man could hire a black singer. Well, in about 1937, I did hire her, 37 or 8, and it worked. I wrote and wrote the lyrics for and arranged a tune called Any Old Time. We were at a layoff one time in Binghamton, New York, or some unlikely place like that, and I thought, well, I'll write a tune for Billy to do with us, and I wrote this tune. And she was just a vocalist in the band, so I wrote one chorus for her to sing. And later, when we were down in New York, we recorded it.
Just remember.
Billie Holiday, whose career, although much more specialized than Judy Garland's, oddly followed the parallel path to chaos and premature death. Another new singer, of a very different kind to either Garland or Holiday, was just celebrating the fact that her latest record was selling in vast quantities. This time, a teenager working with the Chick Webb band in Harlem Savoy Ballroom. One day, this teenager, a certain Miss Ella Fitzgerald, was reminded by the hit record of one of her rivals of an old nursery rhyme.
At the time, Maxine Sullivan was singing Loch Lomond and all that, and we were up in Boston, and Van Alexander, who was arranger for the band at the time, and I was fooling around the piano with Tiska Taska. We used to use it as a game in school, and he said that would make a cute little novelty number because people were going for novelty songs at the time, and he made arrangement. And we tried it in Boston, and everybody liked it, I guess because of the game that they played, you know, the tisket-a-tasket, and it became an overnight hit.
Ella Fitzgerald, still at that time a mere band vocalist, but destined to become a world star in a career happily free from tragedy. This was a time when a popular dance band could have a hit record with a purely instrumental performance. But the whole business was such a crazy lottery that nobody had the foggiest idea if what they were putting on record would sell one copy or millions. It was in 1939 that the band leader Charlie Barnett hit the jackpot, much to his own surprise.
Actually, I heard the tune the first time I heard Basie play it. And, of course, his rendition of it is entirely different than ours. It's a much faster tempo, and it's a different approach to it. But I liked the tune, so I told Billy to make an arrangement of it. Billy May, that is. And he did. He sure did. And at the time we made it, I really, the guy in the control room, the guy by the name of Leonard Joy, who was the A&R man on the date, producer and everything else, we finished it, and he hollered back in, he said, when's your birthday, Charlie? And I said, why? He said, well, you can have the last one, meaning Cherokee. But I didn't have too much confidence in it until all of a sudden, we started getting an awful lot of requests for it. And then I realized that, you know, that we had a good thing there.
Charlie Barnett's band with Ray Noble's composition Cherokee in 1939, a year when all sorts of new stars were beginning to rise. It was almost as though subconsciously people were sensing that an era was coming to an end. Mr. Chamberlain came back from Munich waving his piece of paper, and the Harry Roy band recorded in ill-advised haste a grisly little masterpiece called God Bless You, Mr. Chamberlain. But for two of the big names to come in American musical history, we have to go back to fairly modest beginnings. First, a trombonist, whose reputation as a musician had long been overshadowed by his ability to organize and regiment other musicians into a coherent shape. His name had figured in the lineup of the Ray Noble Orchestra a few years back, but now he was struggling and very nearly going under with his band. His name was Glenn Miller. And among the assets at his disposal, which he still didn't appreciate, was a little musical exercise that he'd worked into a ballad whose title kept mysteriously changing, mainly because of the various lyric writers who had a go at it and never quite came up with the goods. Let's hear one of these lyricists, Edward Heyman, tell his sad tale and then see how the Miller exercise eventually turned out.
The story is that the Miller liked it very much, and I was very excited to have the Miller theme song. And then several people said, "You can't, it's too sad." And the lyric started, "Weep for the rose has no reason to grow now. Weep for the stream has no reason to flow now," and so forth. "Now I lay me down to weep." And they asked me to rewrite it. And foolishly I said, "No, this is written to, I think it's a terribly sad melody, it's a haunting melody, and this is what I think it should be, and I will not rewrite it."
Thank you.
Midnight Serenade. Although in 1939, Glenn Miller was only just breaking through into the superstar class. Had Miller and all the other band leaders only known it, the days of the big bands were already numbered. Partly, of course, the war would be to blame, with thousands of musicians being called up into the armed forces. But there was another factor, even bigger. And to trace its growth, we have to turn to the ranks of one of the most successful of the big bands of the time, Tommy Dorsey. The story is taken up by the young drummer who joined the Dorsey band around this time, Buddy Rich.
I was offered a job with Tommy Dorsey, who was then playing at the Palmer House in Chicago. And I flew to Chicago and listened to the band and decided it was a terrible band and I couldn't fit in that band any more than I could fit into a trunk. You know, it was a Dixieland band. It wasn't quite a jazz band. It wasn't quite a dance band. Dorsey didn't know exactly which way he wanted to go.
India. Tommy Dorsey borrowing there from Rimsky-Korsakov, who was by then too dead to complain. But it was in the ranks of this immensely successful Dorsey band that the new threat to the touring orchestras was slowly maturing. The explanation becomes clear enough if we listen to a bit more of Buddy Rich's recollection of what it was like working for Dorsey.
He hired Cy Oliver to rearrange the band style, to get more of a jazz-oriented feeling. He hired Frank Sinatra to come with the band. He hired the Pied Pipers, which was a marvelous vocal group, along with Joe Stafford. And he hired Connie Haynes. He hired some real good young musicians to come into the band and give it new blood. And so the band did evolve into a fairly good jazz band.
Well, never mind about the fairly good jazz band. I hope you noticed that one of the names Buddy Rich just dropped was Frank Sinatra. Now, Sinatra had joined Tommy Dorsey after starting off with the Harry James Band, and in 1939, while he was still with James, Sinatra made the record that was soon to send him on his way. The record sold about 3 copies. But 2 years later, when the whole world was beating a path to the singer's door, the same record was reissued and sold 1 million. It seemed to be a clear case of all or nothing at all. Gordon Jenkins, who later became Sinatra's musical director, was never in any doubt about Sinatra's status, even in those early days.
There's nobody ever been like him in our time. I don't think we'll ever see anybody that knows as much about singing and is as good as compelling and performing. And we've had an extremely good relationship of mutual respect. And he's an odd... he's a lot different than other people in every way.
Nothing at all. Half a love never appealed to me. If your heart never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing nothing at all. If it's love, there is no in-between. Why begin and cry for something that might have been? No, I'd rather have nothing at all. Oh, please don't bring your lips so close to my cheek. Don't smile or I'll be lost beyond recall. The kiss in your eyes and the touch of your hand makes me weak, and my heart may grow dizzy and fall. And if I fell under the spell of your call, I would be caught in the undertow. And so you see, I've got to say no, no. All or nothing at all.
Sinatra, still relatively unknown in 1939, but destined within a couple of years to change the billing on the record from so-and-so with vocal refrain to so-and-so with instrumental accompaniment. But in 1939, the big bands still seemed secure. This was the year, by the way, that a most extraordinary thing happened. What about complete gibberish as the basis for a song? 1939 saw the rise of a nonsense song which was in a kind of Swedish double talk so authentic that no Swede could make head or tail of it. Goodness knows what people thought it meant, but they seemed happy enough to sing it. Billy Cotton Band. Now, the British never really got around to crooning that highly significant vocal statement till the following year. But one song that was very big in Britain and America in 1939 was yet another hit from the prolific Jimmy Kennedy and Michael Carr. Kennedy seems to have picked up his ideas for songs in the strangest possible way.
Carr came into the office one day, and he said, "I've got the opening for a terrific Western." And he played the first few bars, and I said, "I don't think that's Western, it's much too Spanish." And I thought of the Rio Grande, and I thought, it's the other side. And my sisters had been in California, and they sent me a postcard. A few days previous to this, I received the postcard, and the postcard said, "Today, we have gone Mexican. We're south of the border." And suddenly I thought, this is the title, South of the Border, down Mexico way.
Ay, 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 ay.
Of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray. South of the border, down Mexico way. She was a picture in old Spanish lace, and for a tender while I kissed the smile upon her face. For it was fiesta, and we were so gay. South of the border, down Mexico way. Then she sighed as she whispered, "Mañana," never dreaming that we were parting. And I lied as I whispered, "Mañana," for our tomorrow never came. South of the border, I rode back one day. There in a veil of white, by candlelight, she knelt to pray. The mission bells told me that I mustn't stay. South of the border, down Mexico Bay. Ay, 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 ay. Ay, ay.
South of the Border, sung by the top half of the combination, Gene Autry. One of the biggest hits of the period, and a much parodied item, always a sure indication of a song's lasting fame. When the British weren't puzzling over Swedish nonsense and Mexican tearjerkers, they were concentrating on a much more healthy and satisfying pastime, getting drunk. The song they got drunk to had been originally written by a Czechoslovak composer whose name nobody was able to pronounce then or since, and had had English words added to it. By 1939, its first year in circulation, it had already sold over 500,000 sheet music copies and was destined to become the most popular song in the world during the Second World War. Still, that's not surprising. War is a very thirsty business. So has peace come to that, which is why by mid-1939, everyone was singing the Beer Barrel Polka.
There's a garden, what a garden. Only happy faces bloom there. And there's never any room there for a worry or a gloom there. Oh, there's music and there's dancing and a lot of sweet romancing. When they play the polka, they all get in the swing. Every time they hear that oompa-pa, everybody feels so tra-la-la. They want to throw their cares away. They all go la-di-da-di-a. Then they hear a rumble on the floor. It's a big surprise, they're waiting
before. It's a big surprise they're waiting for. And all the couples, they form a ring. For miles around, you hear them sing. Ring, do, da, do, de, do, da, da.
The Beer Barrel Polka, one of the songs that echoed across England in the last days of peace. Now there was talk of evacuating children from the large cities. Gas mask drill, talk of conscription. It had been only 21 short years since the armistice crowds had swept through London singing Knees Up Mother Brown. Now the whole terrible business was due to start all over again. People perhaps sensed that another chapter in history was ending, and that no matter what might happen in Europe, once the trouble was straightened out, things would never be quite the same again. There is one song that seems to stand for the British generally, and the Londoner in particular, in those last days of peace. The song had already been around for a while when 1939 came along, but it held its popularity for years, and indeed still does. The song came from a London production called For Me and My Girl, whose title echoed an old American standard. And its big song was one of the biggest British hits of all time. But the funny thing is that yet again, a successful song very nearly didn't become associated with the artist who made it famous. As a matter of fact, Lupino Lane reckoned that it was only his superstitious nature that tempted him into For Me and My Girl in the first place.
Well, when R.H. Gillespie asked me to go along and view the Victoria Palace with a view to taking a lease of it, I noticed the secondary lighting was night lights. And as my mother suffered from a phobia, she couldn't sleep in the dark without a nightlight, I thought it was a good sign, so I agreed to go to the Victoria Palace. I always had confidence in it. So had my mother. And before she died, she said, Nip, stick to me and my girl. It's going to be a success.
And now, the song that swept across Britain, and later, during the long war years, came to symbolize peace for the millions who sang it.
Any time you're Lambeth Way, any evening, any day, you'll find us all doing the Lambeth Walk. Every little Lambeth gal takes along her Lambeth pal. You'll find us all doing the Lambeth Walk. Everything bright and breezy, do as you darn well pleasey. Why don't you make your way there, stay there, play there. Once you get down Lambeth Way, any evening, any day, you'll find yourself doing the Lambeth Walk. Everything bright and breezy, do as you darn well please. Why don't you make your way there, go there, stay there.
Once you get down Lambeth Way, any evening, any day, you'll find yourself doing the Lambeth, doing the Lambeth Way.
Ragtime to Rock and Roll was narrated by Kenneth Moore. The program was written by Benny Green, and the research was by Bill Sullivan. The producer was Steve Allen. Next week's program, entitled The Stuff to Give the Troops, deals with the impact of World War II on popular music.